The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. The Premier League, the biggest game in years, happens tonight. City-Liverpool, we'll look ahead to that. And we'll look back at the last couple of days. Madness at Bournemouth. Solskjaer is as good as Busby. And Shelby isn't that sort of player anymore. Spurs stay in the hunt just while there's a huge debate about which was worse, Chelsea-Southampton or Everton-Leicester. We'll talk Pulisic at Chelsea and we'll mourn the end of the Calderwood bounce as Cambridge led in six at Milton Keynes. That plus your questions on today's Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Adam writes, in my opinion, the heavy breather is Lars. The last pod was the smoking gun. How do you plead Lars Sivertsen?
It definitely has been me once. Mm-hmm. And then there was also the time I sounded like I'd ingested a squeaky duck. Mm-hmm. So there's definitely strange things going on with my breathing apparatus. But I think there also has been a phantom breather on pods while I've not been on.
Okay.
But this might be one of those Agatha Christie sort of they were all doing it type things.
It's highly possible that we are all breathing the podcast.
We might just need new microphones. Maybe the equipment is just terrible.
Jonathan Wilson injured in the warm-up today.
Yeah, I've seen it tweak my hamstring coming up the stairs, which is annoying.
I've got to say, and I've done quite a few podcasts and quite a few with Barry, but I've never known anyone to appear less up for a pod than you currently are.
I think that's fair. I'm just very tired. It's all right. I'll find me form somewhere.
So I feel you're in the red zone. I mean, I feel, you know, you podded on Monday. Is it too many pods in too many days? Did we rush you back?
Well, I hope not. We'll find out.
We'll find out. Richard says, is Barry feeling better today?
Yes, significantly better than, I presume, Monday he's talking about when I felt absolutely rotten. Mm-hmm. I had the Christmas lurgy. I came back from Ireland. I thought I was just hungover, but it turned out I was actually proper ill for 3 days, but I'm fine now. Thank you for asking.
Oh, I mean, everybody was worried sick, Barry.
I'd imagine
it's so. It's amazing we managed to get 2-3 pods out without you, isn't it?
Yes. I haven't listened to them. They may have been awful.
Right, let's start. We will look ahead to the game of the Etihad tonight. We'll do a special pod about it as well. Let's do a sort of match of the day running order and start with Bournemouth 3, Watford 3, because that was the most fun. And I'm sure, like a lot of people, I was watching the Newcastle-Manchester United game and the scores kept popping up. And I was like, why don't they just flick to that game? Because it looks a hell of a lot better than what I'm watching. It was fun, wasn't it? Troy Deeney said it was Sunday league defending, Barry.
Yeah, it was absolutely terrific. Great fun for neutrals and, I'd imagine, for all present. Troy Deeney is absolutely correct in his assessment of some of the defending. What was it, 4 goals in 6 minutes? And, you know, it was just a really rollicking good game of football between two teams who probably aren't in much, you know, what danger of going down, although I was starting to get a bit worried about Bournemouth. They were in a bit of a slide and they did well to come back last night from 2-0 down. And that goal they scored where, you know, it was Callum Wilson, Josh King dummies before
beautiful, wasn't it?
Callum Fraser knocked it in. It just shows how quickly a team's confidence can surge back.
Ryan Fraser.
I keep calling him Callum Fraser. It's a thing now. Anyway, sorry, Ryan Fraser scored. But it shows how quickly a team's confidence can surge back because I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that if, you know, Liverpool or Barcelona scored a goal like that, everyone would be really raving about it. That was my favourite of the six.
Lars, did you enjoy it?
Yeah, I have to say I applaud this initiative of just putting amphetamines in all the players' pre-match drinks and just see what happens. You know, I think this is good. This is something that should be done.
Are you suggesting the second half was a come down?
Maybe a little bit. But I like Bournemouth because I might possibly be repeating myself from previously this season. I like the idea that you have a team who they don't really have the resources to challenge seriously for European places. I don't think their aim every season is to stay in the Premier League, and given the stature of the club, it's a great achievement that they continue to do so. But they don't go about it in an attritional way, like so many of these teams who are just trying to scrap to get to enough points to not go down. They play in a really sort of open and attacking manner, and they will have these periods where they're just quite bad and lose a lot of games, sometimes by many goals. But they'll also have runs where they pick up enough points to stay up, and they're generally like a force for good in the league, I feel. And they'd only won twice in the last 12 games, and that was against Brighton and Huddersfield, I believe. So they've not gone through a good patch, and it was good that they at least responded here. But I guess the question you need to ask, because we do keep talking about Eddie Howe as a possible candidate for a bigger job at some point, you do look at how they defend sometimes and wonder that that's something you'll have to get better at if that's going to be a thing.
Troy Deeney scored more than once for the first time since April 2016. But he's an interesting player, Jonathan, isn't he? Because he is a throwback.
He is a throwback. And it's interesting to find an England qualified player who plays regularly for Premier League club who absolutely nobody thinks should be playing for England.
Did he ever get mentioned? See, I'm sure that he's never been...
Well, he probably has, because people mention things, but he hasn't ever been seriously considered. I thought it was interesting what he was saying about the referee as well, about bottling decisions.
Mm.
I think he was right about the two red cards. I think both teams should have had a player sent off. I think he's wrong about the penalty. I don't think that was a penalty.
When he said it, Ryan Fraser's eyebrows popped up. James says, is the worst media decision this week to stand Ryan Fraser next to Troy Deeney? It's amazing that they do the same job, isn't it? Albeit slightly differently, given one is twice the size of the other one.
Yes.
Thank you so much, Jonathan.
Everton West Ham this season, you had Yarmolenko in direct competition with Bernard, and that is a massive size difference.
So the FA Cup, Bournemouth host Brighton, Watford are away at Woking. We've gone Wolves nil, Palace 2 next. I did not predict this, Lars.
Me neither, but it does seem to be a trend that Wolves just struggle against team you think they shouldn't struggle against. I mean, they seem to enjoy playing against the bigger sides. I believe you spoke about it on the pod quite recently, Jonathan, about how they create better chances when they're not in possession a lot of the time, and they can absorb pressure and counter. That seems to be something they enjoy more.
I think it's true of Palace as well. I think Palace prefer to play on the break. I think Wolves, you often see them against a lesser side controlling the ball but not actually doing a huge amount of damage with it, which is a strange... It seems to be a particular trend of Portuguese football, or a certain type of Portuguese football, to do that. If you think back to their golden generation teams that won the two World Youth Cups in 89 and 91, when they came through to be seniors, they played beautiful football, it got nowhere. And I wonder if there's something in the heart of Portuguese coaching that makes them very pretty but not very effective.
But is it not slightly odd that you have a team with Neves and Moutinho in central midfield who are not... doesn't seem that comfortable in games where they can dictate the tempo and stuff.
But there's a difference between being able to hold possession and being able to damage people with it, I think.
So you think it's more that they're like Traore and Jota and these guys are better at countering than actually carving open teams?
Yeah, I would say that.
If you've got two teams who are both better at counter-attacking, should you not just try and give the ball away, you know, just give it to them? I mean, is anyone, you know, it's this idea that both teams would just sort of stand there with the ball in the middle and neither of them want it.
Isn't that sort of a Jose Mourinho philosophy?
Well, it sounds like
give
it.
The ball to the other team.
But I mean, isn't that literally a Simpsons episode?
Yes, it is literally a Simpsons episode. But, you know, if you are better without the ball, then you don't want to have the ball.
Yeah.
So why don't you? I mean, I can see you're really not up for this part. But no, do you see what I mean? I mean, it just doesn't sound right. It's just a weird thing to watch if two teams clearly don't want it, but they feel sort of obliged.
Well,
the
home team sort of feels an obligation, don't they, to do something? I don't know. I mean, what are you suggesting? They just both just... At kick-off, somebody taps the ball, and then they both just stand and watch it. And 45 minutes later, because there'd be no injury time then, the ref blows up and we move on.
Well, I suppose, you know, if you did that as a team, if you just kicked off and then dropped off, the other team would feel so sort of guilty if they didn't go and get the ball either.
It's a test of will, isn't it?
Mm.
Standoff.
I would quite like these two sides to do it. Palace have now scored 8 goals after the 75th minute out of 19 in total. What does that tell us, Lars?
I'm not quite sure, Max, but I note again that Palace had a very high number of shots, but only 3 from Andros Townsend. I am a little bit disappointed that this wonder goal from City hasn't prompted a sort of spectacular long shot bonanza from Townsend, who should now be shooting more, and again outshot by Pat Van Aanholt from left back. Strange stuff.
It's a big result for Palace though, because they were the sort of top of those teams that could still go down, and they still could. Obviously, it's only one victory, but that gap, they're sort of bridging the gap between Brighton, who we think are safe, and the teams below Newcastle.
Well, they've
who
kept
aren't.
8 clean sheets this season, Palace, I think. So if they actually could find somebody to put the ball in the net, they'd be...
Well, now that Jordan Ayew has finally scored a goal for them...
He was offside, though, wasn't he?
I think he was, yes. But he was clearly absolutely overjoyed to get off the mark. I mean, I think he was practically in tears, wasn't he? But he could go on something of a scoring run. I have my doubts, because I don't rate him. I think he's got a bad attitude and he's a malign dressing room influence, and I'm surprised Palace went for him in the first place, but at least he has scored. I find it weird that Palace are better on the road than they are at home, because they, you know, Selhurst Park's one of very few Premier League grounds that's sort of a bona fide bear pit.
And you'd think that has changed this year, hasn't it, when those people not sitting where they were sitting.
And what, one of the few Premier League grounds where John Bruin's been sick, we learned on Monday.
Yes.
On the subject of teams just not wanting to attack, it reminds me of when Norway got knocked out of the World Cup in 1998 against Italy. Because under Egil Olsen, the Norwegian strategy was famously to whack it long and to try to not have possession. He believed having possession was a very dangerous thing indeed, and he wanted instead to catch people on the break and some such. This is unfortunate when you then concede the first goal, because the Italians scored first and the Norwegians proceeded to continue defending, hoping that the Italians would, you know, commit men forward. And
was that 98?
Yes.
Okay.
And it was actually, the funny thing was that Paolo Maldini was actually quite offended by the whole spectacle, telling the media afterwards that, "I don't understand them. They were 1-0 down and still didn't want to come out to play. Did they expect us to attack when we were winning? Do they think we were stupid?" He asked. And I guess
Italy's not the team to do that again.
No, they just seemed disgusted with the whole affair. Which, since we're having a small history lesson here,
okay.
Egil Olsen, manager of Norway, was typically, you know, blunt afterwards, saying that Italy, they are a bad team. They were mediocre and we should have done better. He thought they were very bad.
Thanks, Lars. Wolves host Liverpool on Monday night. Palace host Grimsby Town, the magic of the cup.
BBC are showing that Wolves-Liverpool match in a classic BBC, really picking the wrong games to show in the FA Cup.
Yeah, but the trouble is Liverpool and Man United get the viewers, right? So you have to... The BBC, I suppose, aren't dictated by viewers. So I don't know who's got the United game. But that's why they do it.
There's quite a lot of interesting third round cup ties. That is not one of them.
Huddersfield 1, Burnley 2. Is that it, Jonathan, for Huddersfield?
I mean, 8 defeats in a row. It's that's not good, is it? I think that was a game they really had to win if you're going to get back into it. So in the gap now, them to Cardiff in fourth bottom is 8 points. So yeah, that's going to take some making up.
Do we mind, Barry, if Huddersfield go down? It's a nice story for them to be in the Premier League, but they're not lighting it up, are they?
No, they deserve to go down. I think them staying up last season was... They were punching well above their weight. I still don't think it should be that difficult to not be in the worst three teams in the Premier League. But they clearly are the worst team in the Premier League at the moment, and it's difficult to see them. They already look to have raised the white flag. They look to a completely beaten docket on Saturday, and David Wagner, who's always tried to look on the bright side of even the worst defeat, he looked pretty much last night as if he knows the jig is up.
Well, that red card as well, it's such a thing that happens to a relegated team, of a player committing a foul, believing he hasn't been booked, and then discovering all too late he has already been booked.
I didn't see the first yellow. Did the ref point it in his face, do we know? Was it really obviously booked, and then he just was forgetful?
Well, it was Mike Dean. There's not going to be a subtle yellow card.
That's true.
I don't know, because I mean, all I saw was on TV, and you see Mike Dean raising the yellow card in the very elegant way that Mike Dean does. I got no idea in which direction your man was watching.
It is interesting that it's not the first time they've had a first half red card. I mean, they got a first half red card at home to Brighton as well, and they got a red at home to Cardiff after an hour. And if you're Huddersfield, those are the kind of games that you really need to not get a guy sent off, because that's where you're looking to pick up your points.
And look, the difference between these two sides is Burnley have, I know it must be devastating for you that Burnley have won two in a row, Lars, but they've got players that can score goals, right?
They do. I've flip-flopped so many times on this, I don't remember where I was at the last time. I think I've said they'll be fine and they won't get relegated. But anyway, I think with regards to the Huddersfield, they seem to me, without knowing the ins and outs of their books and all that, they haven't gone wild in the transfer market. It looks like they've kept the sort of wage budget at a fairly sensible level, so they shouldn't go under by any means when they go back down again. So it's not a massive disaster. I think they've done tremendously well to get up and stay there for a season.
Yeah, I think their chairman has said, listen, they want to survive, but they're not going to go mad and bankrupt the club. They're quite well run.
I think they were being wise to break the bank to try and stay up, because they seem to have a problem attracting players. They're not a particularly fashionable club. There was talk this morning that Jason Puncheon is going to go there. He's been told he can leave Palace, but you know they're going to need more than him to stay up, you'd imagine.
Did anyone feel sorry for Robbie Brady and that red card?
Well, Jermaine Gina seemed to. I don't really know why. I mean,
it looked like a yellow to me. I
don't have much sympathy for anybody who just sort of lunges through to me from behind. I mean, okay, technically maybe it wasn't quite aggressive enough to get a red, but it's totally cynical. Hmm. Putting your studs on somebody's calf.
Do you think it was even more cynical because he was just grinning about it afterwards? He seemed sort of giddy with happiness that it had happened.
He's a man with an annoying face.
Oh.
Oh, he did in that instance. An annoying expression, maybe, is a better way of putting it.
And he has the most Dublin accent I've ever heard, Robbie Brady. He deserves a red card for that alone. I think, remember when he scored that goal against Italy, he was interviewed afterwards and he said, I'm over the moon. Some Dubliners have this unique way of turning a one-syllable word into two or three syllables. Well, his rendition of Mewin.
Where's our next live show, Baz?
Dublin. I'm not insulting him particularly. It's
you sure?
I'm not. Brian Kerr, the former Ireland manager, was another one. You know, Mewin. But I thought Isaac Mpenza was quite lucky not to see red, because it looked to me like he stuck the nut on Brady after the tackle, and that seemed to go unpunished.
In a full nut or a footballer one?
A footballer connect
heads and then push.
The footballer rutting stag, one. I believe, is the official
term. The rutting stag.
Is it your official position, Baz, that Brady should just be sent off whenever he's on the pitch for his general sort of...
Just for having a Dublin accent? No, not at all.
I mean, that would make him a bit of a liability to whatever.
Robbie Keane would never have lasted long, or Damien Duff either.
If you are in and around the Dublin area, the 21st of January, there are still a few tickets left. Where you can throw whatever you like at Barry, joined by me, Lars, and Paolo Bandini. The 22nd with Barney is sold out. Not because of Barney, let's be clear about that. That was the one we put tickets on sale for first. It's the start of our residency. Huddersfield away at Bristol City. Burnley host Barnsley in the FA Cup. To the London Stadium, West Ham 2, Brighton 2. Marko Arnautovic. You love him, Lars. Do you love Arnautovic more than you hate Burnley? Where's the line?
I love players who are slightly different and a bit weird, and particularly players who are sort of written off as being idiots who then turn it around and turn into sort of productive members of the sport. I've got a bit of a soft spot for... I kept hoping Bentner would come good. It just never happened.
Do you think Arnautovic could sort of be like Shaqiri and go to a big club and do that? He's a different type of player, but that sort of role, or is that too good for him?
No, I think that's possible. The only thing you would say is, like, age is not quite on his side. I mean, West Ham would want a massive fee for him, and rightly so. He's 29, so not many clubs might want to pay that.
Brighton keep getting points. I'd be disappointed to lose a two-goal lead. But do you believe, Jonathan, we haven't given Chris Hughton anywhere near the credit that he deserves?
I think I've given him exactly the right amount of credit.
How much credit have you given him?
I don't care about everybody else. No, I mean, he's done a really good job. Clearly, he's done a really good job. With one of the biggest budget, they've made the most of that. I think they've scored 9 goals from set plays now this season. So, yeah, as we learned at the World Cup, set plays are still a way you can gain an advantage by practising that. So, yeah, he's done a really, really good job. And, you know, did anybody when at the beginning of the season, when you're predicting people to go down, did anybody predict Brighton to go down? You just don't. You don't think of them as relegation fodder now. You think of them as a mid-table club.
And while we're apportioning credit, Pellegrini deserves some, doesn't he, Baz? I definitely remember a time when we didn't think West Ham would get a point until November.
Did we?
Pellegrini's... Yeah, that was me. Sorry about that.
That's okay.
I got that one wrong. I was right about Houghton, but wrong about that.
Oh, fine.
Manuel Pellegrini's clearly a good manager, and you could argue that West Ham are maybe a bit beneath a man of his talents. I might as well endure myself to West Ham fans.
Our next light, we're playing the London Stadium in a few months.
I don't know if Pellegrini had a very heavy Christmas, but he looked terrible last night. Like, really haggard, sort of pink-eyed. He was like the...
You're not saying Pellegrini has pink eye?
What? What does that mean?
Isn't that when you...
You don't have kids, do you?
No.
No, pink eye is when it's when you... get feces in your eyes, isn't it?
No, conjunctivitis. It's an eye condition you can get.
Well, I mean, I've had conjunctivitis. I've never been smearing shit in my own eyes.
But it's not...
you can't just go around pointing at people with pink eyes saying, oh, you put shit in your eye, you deserve it, you prick.
It's not smearing.
Just no one's really suggesting that Pellegrini has been smearing shit in his eyes.
I'm just looking at producer Jonathan's face. is this where it goes? Maybe he did a Happy Christmas. He's not young Pellegrini, is he?
He looks like the... He looks like the portrait in the attic of his, you know, some younger Pellegrini kind of is romping around somewhere.
He looks more like a ghost than any other Premier League manager, or indeed any other manager I can think of. And he may have been starring in A Christmas Carol while, you know, over Panto season or something. I would argue he's just one decent short back and sides away from looking 10 or 15 years younger, or possibly even alive.
So he needs to go on one of those sort of this morning style makeovers.
No, he just needs a decent, proper haircut.
Okay. Would you say Roy looks significantly younger than him?
No, but he looks more alive. Or, sorry, less undead. This is very unkind.
Less undead, more dead.
Producer Jonathan's just written, please. West Ham are at home against Birmingham, Brighton away at Bournemouth. And that'll do for part one. In part two, we'll start St James's Park and the Ole Gunnar Solskjaer revolution continues. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. At St James's Park, Manchester United won 2-0. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer bringing on Romelu Lukaku and him scoring with his first touch. The man is a genius, Barry.
Romelu Lukaku or Ole Gunnar Solskjaer?
Ole Gunnar Solskjaer.
Yeah, well, it was an inspired substitution because obviously Lukaku scored with, I think, his first touch. Mm-hmm. He's a player whose confidence is probably shot. That'll do help him no end. And, I mean, Manchester United ran out comfortable winners in the end, but for quite a long time, Newcastle, I thought, might do a number on them. I thought they played very well, just lacking a little bit of quality up front.
Mm. Yeah, if he had a right foot, it might have been a different story, because he twice got through and insisted on taking it on his left when it, you know, seemed more natural to take it on his right.
Is it criminal for a professional footballer to not be able to kick the ball with both feet?
I don't think it's so.
Criminal. I mean, you know, you start jailing people for that. Where does it end? You know,
okay, unforgivable.
Overfilled as it is.
That's true.
You know. Well, you'd hope, but you know, Puskás only had one foot. Maradona was massively left-footed.
Ole Gunnar Solskjaer was talking about Marcus Rashford. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer was talking about Marcus Rashford before the game and said, I've seen him rush a few finishes. He thinks I've got to get a shot off early when sometimes you just pass it past the keeper. And he said, look, Rashford is clearly a better footballer than me, but that's one thing he could learn. And I know we've sort of gone down that you could have put a golden retriever or, you know, just a happy puppet in charge of Manchester United and they'd be better. But that might be something that Solskjaer is doing, is giving confidence to the centre forwards.
Well, he's certainly giving everyone confidence, and definitely, whatever questions there are about his coaching credentials, teaching a young forward how to finish, you'd think would be something Ole Gunnar Solskjaer could absolutely do. And they got a clean sheet here, that's good, and it wasn't a great performance at all, but it does feel like one of those games that earlier in the season would have petered out as a sort of drab 0-0, and Mourinho would have, you know, blamed his forwards for being bad, and that would have been that.
I suppose at half time, it was the first time when you watched Manchester United and you felt it was a bit more like the old Manchester United than the one we've seen in the last.
It was actually quite a similar
games.
Game to the equivalent match last season, which Newcastle ended up winning 1-0. But yeah, this time they had the wherewithal to drag it their way.
Adamson says, was the Shelby tackle the worst tackle ever, where the tackler has gestured for the tacklee to get up and look shocked at the ref's foul call? Note, Ben Thatcher's elbow not included for discussion's sake. I mean, it was a terrible tackle from Jonjo Shelvey, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was pretty bad. I don't understand how he wasn't sent off for it, but awful. And I wasn't aware he'd protested his innocence too much. Like, I saw him laughing at Pogba when Pogba was understandably furious with him. And you could have had a situation where Pogba had gone for him and Pogba would have got the red card. So, but yeah, it's not really up for debate. It was an awful challenge.
And on Shelby, it's interesting because he came on and he is clearly a lovely footballer. And although I think England have moved past that now and are very hopeful, there was always talk of, you've got to, why is Shelby not in the England squad? And this idea that Southgate had a problem with him potentially doing exactly that.
Yeah, and, well, I mean, when this question was raised, I think the reason that Southgate never even really bothered looking at him was because he made a decision when qualification ended on a sort of a rough, sort of, you know, a putative 30-man squad he's going to choose from. And Shelvey, at that point, had just picked up a second red card of the season. Both of them for stupid, and one was for stamp on somebody, I can't remember what the second one was. But, you know, both for stupid things. And you sort of think, well, you can't trust him. And, you know, he hadn't had a red card since, I think it's over a year now since the last red card. But that, yeah, that should have been a red, shouldn't it? I mean, there's no question it should have been a red.
Newcastle host Blackburn. I mean, Lascelles as well, actually, was lucky
not
to go, wasn't he?
I mean, he generally seemed to have a pretty good game, but yes, he should have gone.
Really, that's a bit sort of soapboxy for me, because I've said this before, but like, you spend so much energy and sort of frothing in fury over diving in this country, like the challenges like the Shelby one and to an extent Lascelles one, it was a much bigger problem with much more potential consequences.
Well, there's a lot of bad tackles generally last night. I think it was 6 red card tackles last night. Why did I say that without thinking how many were actually punished? But there was the 2 in the Watford-Bournemouth game, there was the 2 in that game, and there were some others as well.
So, well, in addition
Robbie
to
Brady's, which was punished.
Yeah, yeah.
In addition to the diving committee we want to set up, I think we should also have like a foul play committee that could hand out bad.
Well, I mean, that is an interesting point, is that because the referee saw Shelby's foul and gave a free kick, you can confirm this laws, Lars, but no retrospective action can be taken, or it could be taken.
I think they can, but what I read in the Chronicle this morning was that they can, but they're reluctant to do so, which is, I think it's just nonsensical. I think if it had a clear view of it, it would have been a straight red and a 3-match ban. So
who's reluctant to do so? Why would you be reluctant?
FA, I believe.
And why would they be reluctant?
You're asking the wrong guy. I want a commission to ban all these guys.
Well, I think there's a sense that, once you start re-refereeing games, it's a thin end of the wedge. Where does that end? How many decisions do you reconsider? So I understand why they're reluctant to do it. I do think a tackle that bad, it's probably one of it. You know, I think that is a case of exceptional circumstances. They say they can reassess. But I mean, I think the onus should be on the referees. I don't think there should be any shame for referee when, yeah, filing a report after the game to say, actually, my vision for this was slightly blocked. I realised he'd fouled him. I didn't realise how bad it was. Had I seen it clearly, I'd have sent him off.
Or even to say, I made a mistake on this and it should be this. I mean, there's no people make mistakes, right?
So just a commission after every round where they look at diving and violent and dangerous incidents and hand out bans.
Seems too sensible an idea, Lars.
Yeah.
Cardiff 0, Tottenham 3. Weird game, Jonathan. Tottenham had basically won it by the 26th minute.
Yeah, and it was petered out and it was pretty dull, but they were very good in that first half hour. Kane is obviously back in form after whatever slight dip he had after the World Cup. Son looking excellent again, and you know, his imminent departure for the Asian Cup, I think, is a worry for Tottenham.
That Eriksen touch was beautiful, wasn't it? I've vaguely seen something like it before, but I can't really remember where he flicks it back and then prods it forward to just create a tiny bit of space and then basically does two defenders and the keeper with the eyes. He's a stunning footballer.
He's a superb player, and I wonder if Spurs have kind of sleepwalked into an Arsenal situation here, because if I recall correctly, he's only got 18 months left of his contract which is a really awkward position for them to
be in. Well, that's odd, because Tottenham are so kind of good at contracts. That suggests to me that there might be something else going on there.
Yeah, and with them having finally handed out quite a significant contract to Harry Kane, and rightly so, because of his status at the club, you could understand Eriksen for asking Levy for very similar money, and the club might...
Well, I can understand any player at Tottenham just sort of waiting to see what happens.
Yeah, because Pochettino might leave in the summer as well.
Yeah.
Spurs with 9 wins in their last 11. They play United next, which will be interesting to see how United do against one of the top clubs, but a big game for Spurs. After that, they've got Fulham away, Watford, Newcastle... and Leicester at home, then Burnley away.
Well, that gap now, United to fourth, is only 6 points, which if you think a fortnight ago, it was 11 points, and we sort of thought, there's no way United can haul that back. Maybe they can haul it back.
And what about Spurs? I think they're about 20-1 Spurs to win the league. But
yeah, they're not going to win the league.
Okay. No one gives them any hope whatsoever?
No.
Neil Warnock, after the game, said Spurs shouldn't be allowed into their new ground because... they might be worse at their new ground than Wembley, and it will give their relegation rivals an advantage.
What?
Well, I mean, that was sort of my reaction. You're just shaking your head, Lars.
Yep. But
they might
be
better.
And I've got nothing to add.
I mean, they might be better at the new ground. They might sign a player in January who makes them better or worse. I mean, things do change over seasons. Warnock's probably the youngest looking of the 70-pluses in the Premier League managers.
Hmm.
He seems bizarrely happy these days.
Yeah, this was the first time that he was slightly sort of deflecting from his own team's performance. They have a problem against the top six where they just get hammered by whoever it is they're playing. And before the game, he was saying, listen, against Manchester United, we let in a goal after 2 minutes. That's the key. We shouldn't do this. And then they let a goal in after 3 minutes.
But then, to be fair to them, they're 17th on 18 points, you know, just actually 4 points up to 14th, you know. Before the season, they would have been very, very happy to be in that position in January. So, you know, I think he's done a really good job.
Yeah, I agree with you. They're away at Gillingham in the Cup. Spurs away at Tranmere on Friday night. Craig Bellamy says he stepped down from his position as the under-18 coach pending a club investigation into allegations of bullying. He says he will fully cooperate with the club inquiry. He categorically refutes allegations made against him. The player... who's made them? His player's dad used to be a Premier League footballer. I don't know if that makes a difference. It's quite an interesting part to that story.
Well, I suppose he has an insight into the game. I've read the story. It seems quite disturbing, but obviously not really in a position to comment on it. But I was surprised to read it. And bullying at football clubs seems to be a massive problem.
Mm. It's interesting. The Aston Villa story is an interesting one, where Gareth Farrelly came out about Kevin McDonald and only sort of told his story because he'd seen McDonald had got accused of it again in sort of 2015, 2016. And I think, you know, time moves on, doesn't it? And I think it's interesting. It's interesting now to hear footballers 30 years ago saying, actually... this really wasn't on. When you're in that situation as a kid, you just don't really know, do you? It's just
the class of 92, you know, suggested bullying was rampant at Manchester United. It's not just, you know, Aston Villa or United or Cardiff. It's not just football.
No.
You know, we've had the incident with the Sales Sharks director of rugby having a go at a journalist in a press conference, and he's been accused of bullying players,
cycling stories,
and it's in all walks. It's not just sport; it's all walks of life. Mm. You know, I went to a boarding school where bullying was rampant. It happens in the workplace. It happens all over the schools, and it's really unpleasant if you're on the receiving end of it. But to suggest it's all Kevin McDonald or Craig Bellamy's fault or whoever, you know, it's just a rampant thing, and it's really not nice.
Mm. There's an interesting point with elite sport, I think, that the idea that you've got to be mentally tough to succeed is true, and you have to learn that mental toughness, I guess, which means the line is, it's complicated as where bullying begins.
Yeah, but then you can also see why that legitimizes the culture of bullying.
Absolutely right.
That you know, there's a legitimate being tough on somebody, and I don't know, they finish a race and they, a second off their PB or whatever, and you have a go at them for not pushing that extra bit, is probably fair enough. But if that becomes ingrained, becomes sort of institutionalized, you can see how that rapidly kind of degenerates into something
or
that's not acceptable.
Or uneven, right? When the whole point of youth coaches, you want them to treat... A, you don't want them to bully anyone, and you want them to treat everyone exactly the same.
Well, up to a point, yeah. I mean, I think different people respond to different stimuli, so there's a basic level of behaviour, the basic standard of how you act, but I think some people you'd be tougher on and some people you wouldn't. It just depends on their personality, you know.
Well, we'll see what...
But, and also, I think there's a point that there's a huge difference between an elite athlete at the very top of their game trying to get that extra 1, 2% and a kid who's just learning the game. Yeah, the standards that you expect of them are very different, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's an interesting story. We'll see how, see what happens with the Craig Bellamy story. Arsenal 4, Fulham 1. Looks like an easy win for Arsenal. Lars, it wasn't that easy, wasn't it? Sessegnon had two really good chances before. And, you know, Fulham could have got something out of the game.
Yeah, the four goals is maybe a little bit harsh on Fulham, who do look... less incompetent defensively than they did. They're still not very good at the back, but they're improving a little bit, and I certainly wouldn't write them off just yet, even though they're in quite a precarious position. Arsenal, they've got... There's a lot of things that's not right with that squad, but they do have some really good quality going forward in the shape of Lacazette and Aubameyang and these guys, so in any given game where the rest of the team can provide them with some kind of platform, and especially against weaker teams, you'd fancy them to pick up a lot of points, to be honest.
Unai Emery was booed actually when he took Lacazette off, and he said, "I won't
really,
give in to mob
really
rule."
Weird.
Say again.
It's really strange to boo in that circumstance with Arsenal doing his
But there are Arsenal fans, you know, they're entitled. Just we've seen what they're like in recent seasons, and what would you expect from a pig? Only a grunt.
Ryan Sessegnon's had an interesting season. I mean, I think everybody, and I don't know if put too much pressure on him or expectations were too high. This is a young guy, right?
He's 18 years old.
He's 18. He had a great season last season. He missed another chance at Anfield, didn't he? I think it was in Jokanovic's last game. So we shouldn't be surprised. And he's also playing in a team that aren't doing very well. I wonder if he was playing for, say, Wolves or Bournemouth or something, that he would naturally be having a better season.
Well, the two chances he had... the first one, he sort of snatched that, looked a bit sort of panicky and twitchy. The second one, I think, was a worse miss. The first one just looked like he
I think the first one's an easier chance.
Yeah, but you can sort of...
Because he's in control of the ball, right? It's easier
but
if
it was
you're
a
running
very
through.
Sort of... it was like he tried to be too quick, and you could sort of understand why that happens. The second one, I sort of... But yeah, he's 18, you know.
He's very young, and across the season he's actually ended up playing left-back quite a bit, which I think maybe not a great idea, given that he's very young and very raw and played his best football going forwards last season anyway.
Three clean sheets in 21 games for Arsenal. Aaron Ramsey is now allowed to sign a pre-contract for a free transfer at the end of the season. The teams who want him: Juventus, PSG, Real Madrid, Bayern Munich, Inter. That's the reigning champions of Italy, Germany and France, as well as last year's Champions League winners. You would wonder if all those teams wanted your player, you might just check if he's any good or not.
I can't help but feel there's something going on behind the scenes there, that there's more to this than meets the eye, because he's one of their best players, in my opinion. And as you say, all those teams want him. If they all want him for a reason.
And the only sort of logical reason could be if, I mean, his wages demands presumably are pretty high. We know the Premier League wages are inflated compared to the rest of Europe. And it may be that Emery realises that if he's going to shape the squad as he needs it, he needs to free up that money. And if he doesn't see Ramsey as being quite a fit for his style of football, that may legitimise it.
But so Ozil doesn't quite fit his style of football, and Ramsey doesn't quite fit his style of football. So who fits his style of football? Because they're quite different players play in similar positions, right?
I would have thought Ramsey would have been adaptable to it, but he obviously doesn't fancy him.
And it's the big question mark is we don't really know what he's asked for in terms of wages, but the only logical thing would be that it would be quite a lot. And, you know, he's 28. He has an injury record. He seems to break down quite often, and Arsenal already have a number 10 who they can't quite fit in on massive wages. You can kind of understand why they might not want another one of those.
Chelsea 0, Southampton 0. Disappointing for Southampton to get a decent point and still drop into the relegation zone, but that is what's happened. The game itself was truly tragically boring. Chelsea have bought Christian Pulisic for £58 million. He's going to be loaned back to Dortmund until the end of the season. What type of player is he, Lars?
He's technically quite good. technically very good. He's a good dribbler. He can pick a pass. He's. I think if you look at what was wrong with Chelsea in this game, and actually what's been a little bit wrong with them recently, is that their possession game looks a little bit stagnant. They keep the ball very well, but it's ended up being they tend to pass the ball around and wait for Hazard to do something. I mean, he would be very much another attacking player who can create spaces and find openings and this sort of thing.
But so, a lot of Chelsea fans are saying, well, this means Hazard's off, but he's more a compliment to Hazard than he is a
replacement. I agree. I think he complements Hazard. He would complement Hazard very well. I think that's a very easy conclusion to draw, but I don't necessarily agree. Interesting with the pronunciation of his surname, I suspect, because you've said it right. I mean, he says Pulisic himself, but I wonder if Jonathan, you might feel. I mean,
it's what he says it is, because I mean, he's obviously of Croatian descent, so in Croatia it would be Pulisic or even Pulisic. I don't know if there's an accent on the S.
Yeah.
But you know, he's American, so he prefers an anglicised pronunciation.
So I'm looking forward to hordes of people on the internet pointing out that you've missaid it wrong, Max, when you have in fact said it right. That'll be fun.
It's also a sign of quite how well Jadon Sancho is doing, isn't it, at Dortmund, that they're happy to let Pulisic go.
That is true. His contract was running out. He had 18 months left on his contract, and he's been very clear, Pulisic, about not wanting to extend it and wanting to move to England. So from Dortmund's perspective, it's an amazing deal, because you know they get to keep him for the rest of the season, which reportedly is something Pulisic wanted, because he wanted to join Chelsea in the summer so he'd have a full run-up, full pre-season, so he could integrate more well into the team. But for Dortmund, they're effectively selling a player with 18, 12 months left on his contract for a huge fee, who wasn't the first name on the team.
Well, he's only played 479 minutes of league football this season.
But you wonder if that has something to do with Favre being slightly more direct and favouring the sort of pace and unpredictability of Sancho over the slightly more intricate stylings of Pulisic. But I think in terms of just how dire. It's really turgid recently with Chelsea, because they're not creating enough openings. And we talk about Sarri ball and possession and all of this, and Barry has really switched off now, I think, but that's okay. One of the things Napoli were so good at was these quick little passing combinations in small areas of space, and Chelsea haven't quite mastered that, and I think that's something he will really add to them.
Is Pulisic... better than Callum Hudson-Odoi, who weirdly already is at Chelsea and now looks likely to be drummed out
to Bayern Munich, apparently. Yeah.
Well, yes, I think he's quite a lot better. But the question is, will Hudson-Odoi end up going to a Bundesliga club, having a massive breakthrough, and then be signed back to England for like a silly free by someone? I mean, that's the big question.
It is. Chelsea Forest in the cup, Southampton away at Derby. Everton 0, Leicester 1. I mean, this was arguably the worst football match I've ever seen.
That's a big show.
I was at a terrible hangover. It was January the 1st, and that is true. There was a Cheltenham game in the LDV vans once, which was a disaster, but and it was cold. At least I was warm, but I was under a blanket, and I was just thinking, this is terrible. And I really think early kickoffs, this is too early for everyone to be ready. It's, you know, the players have got to get up and have boiled fish at 8 a.m. Nobody wants that. They're not ready. The fans aren't ready. And I wondered if you could take the early game package and move it to after the late package. So the Saturday, you don't have a 12:30. You just have a 5:30 and a 7:45.
There speaks a man who doesn't cover games. No, get the game on as early as possible. Get home, get in the pub. Nobody wants a 7:30 kick-off on a Saturday.
Fans, but do away fans, would they rather, if they could get home, and I know there's a public transport issue at weekends, if they could get home, would they rather leave later and have a build-up to a game and go to the pub and have a pint and watch the game and get back late? Or would they rather have to get up and leave at 6 a.m. or whatever to get to a game that starts at midday and get... I'm ignoring the journalists for a second, Jonathan, and forgive me.
Nobody remembers the journalists.
I'm thinking of the fans. I wonder if they'd prefer that. And so if you had Super Sunday as 3 o'clock and 5 o'clock kickoffs rather than 1:30 and 4.
Well, you're presuming all football fans have the same opinion on...
That's true.
So some might prefer an early kickoff, others a late one. I mean, there's every chance Everton v Leicester is going to be an absolute abomination no matter what time you put it on at. And
I actually quite enjoyed it. I mean,
No,
because I'd done 2 park runs in the morning.
Yeah.
And I had a bit of brunch afterwards, and I come back in, and I could just doze in a chair in front of it, and it didn't really matter what it was. It wasn't taxing.
Well, I mean, yes, but you might as well watch, you know, the Borrowers. Do you know what I mean?
But watch the Borrowers then, you know. I can't remember what game I was watching during the week. I just gave up and watched Muppet Christmas Carol. Instead, you know, there are options.
Which is excellent.
Oh, it's an absolute classic, Stonewall classic.
Michael Caine's greatest performance?
Possibly.
Yeah, but arguably, I'm paid to watch and talk about the football. I would probably rather watch a Muppets Christmas Carol in that situation.
Just as a, bringing it back to what we were talking about, just as a person who likes watching football and very much likes being awake later on in the day than I like being awake early in the day, just as a general point. I quite like late games, but I think quite a lot of fans might have trouble with their travel arrangements, yeah. I expect. Yeah. I mean, and that's not just away fans. I mean,
even a 4 o'clock game on a Sunday, it can be difficult to get a train back.
The other thing, if you
think of fans in, you know, as a whole rather than the ones necessarily going to that game, it is quite nice going to the pub before your game and watching another game.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I wasn't trying to make a flippant point because I generally think the standard of football is not as good in those early kickoffs, and that may just be anecdotal.
I mean,
it may also be
that they tend not to put the better games on then. The better games are saved for the later slots.
What you also don't want is the situation that you've had in Spain. It's a couple of times where you have games kicking off very late in places where there's like patchy public transport, and it just becomes a
fire. It's imperfect, right?
The scheduling aside, these are two just weird teams. I mean, Everton were so bad in this. And they should be a lot better. Yeah,
their record is the same this season as last season. Identical in terms of wins, draws and defeats.
Okay,
yeah.
I presume it's now worse.
And then if you look at Leicester's...
After 21 games.
No, it's exactly the same.
Okay.
Leicester's festive results, they lose against Crystal Palace and Cardiff and beat Chelsea, Man City and Everton. Admittedly, Everton were hideously bad, but... just two weird teams.
Shane says the two teams playing as if they've forgotten the importance of the Everton Cup.
The other strange thing about scheduling is, why were there only 3 games on New Year's Day? Why were there all the games last night? Or so many of the games last night? Because surely it's easier for people to get to them on New Year's Day when it's a bank holiday.
Good question. Everton host Lincoln in the Cup. Lincoln go very well in League 2. Leicester away to Newport County. In the Football League, Steve Bruce has been appointed manager of Sheffield Wednesday. The journalist Ian Baker writes, it appears as if Steve Bruce's arrival as the new Wednesday boss has been delayed as he wants to tick off an item on his bucket list, seeing an England cricket test in the West Indies. They play in Barbados starting on January the 23rd.
You know who Ian Baker is, right? He's the ostrich.
Oh, is he the one who Nigel Pearson said was an ostrich?
Yeah.
Oh, right. Well, if Steve
But that Bruce... doesn't necessarily mean he is an ostrich.
No, I mean, I was there and he was very much un-ostrich-like.
Mm. I mean, in a way, you know, whenever you get a new job, the first thing that anyone says to you is, you managed to get a good holiday between the last job and this job, and you go, oh, no, I've got to go straight. I finish on the Friday, I'm in on the Monday. So good for Steve Bruce. Wednesday 16.
Apparently it's a promise he made to his dad, or he was going to go with his dad until his dad passed away.
So that puts a totally different spin on the whole story, doesn't it? It makes it more poignant.
But wasn't he manager of someone else when his dad passed away, which...
Villa.
Mm. So he was obviously expecting to be free around now to go to the cricket. so I don't know. I'd like to know what else is on Steve Bruce's bucket list.
Presumably not writing a book, because that's been done.
Yes. Well, if you'd like to speculate, I will happily take those messages.
Write a film script based on the book.
He could take the record for most promotions out of the championship in his own right, because he's currently shares it with Warnock, I think.
He'd do well with Wednesday at the moment. They're 16th.
Well, next season.
4 wins in 3 months. In between what was the boring Everton-Leicester and the quite boring Cardiff-Spurs was a brilliant game between Forest and Leeds. Forest were one up. Leeds had Calvin Phillips sent off. They went 2-1 up, and then 3 goals in 8 minutes saw Forest win 4-2. And there were rumours that Aitor Karanka was going to be sacked at any point during that game. They kept flashing to the chairman of Nottingham Forest whenever he wasn't smiling, and they're like, it doesn't matter what happens now. But Karanka seems to have had a stay of execution. Chris Wilder's Sheffield United beat Wigan 3-0. Billy Sharp scoring his 220th goal since his debut in 2004, making him the highest scoring Englishman this century, one ahead of Ricky Lambert. Hull beat Bolton 6-0, 5 of those goals coming after the hour. Hull on a great run of form. Big wins at the bottom for Rotherham, 2-1 over Preston and Millwall, who are now on a 3-match winning streak. They beat bottom-placed Ipswich 3-2. Ipswich look absolutely doomed. In League One, 3 goalless draws. Fun for Bristol Rovers and Burton, Luton, Barnsley and Shrewsbury and Fleetwood fans. 3 of the bottom 5 won. Oxford drop into the bottom 4 as a result, thanks to their 3rd defeat in a row. Portsmouth are still top, 5 points ahead of Luton, beating bottom place Wimbledon 2-1. And you're still 3rd, Barry and Wilson.
Yeah. 7,800 Sunderland fans made the trip to Blackpool.
And Jack Colback, your former man, scored twice for the Forest. I didn't know where he'd gone, and there he was.
He's a good footballer, Colback.
Yeah, he is. In League 2, top 7 all won. That's the sort of insight you come to the Guardian Football Weekly for. Top 7 all won. Apart from Lincoln in top spot, their lead has been cut to 4 points. Second place MK Dons had a tough game at home to Cambridge, but were 3 up after 12 minutes. It's totally devastating. You can't. It's just when it just goes goal, goal, goal on Soccer Saturday, they're all against you, and you're like, oh, this is a total disaster. Mansfield beat Grimsby 1-0 away. They're 3rd. Extraordinary record. They've drawn half of their 24 games so far. Just 1 defeat and 11 wins, 12 draws. 4th, 5th, and 6th are all on 43 points. 7th and 8th on 42 points. Long way to go in the Football League, and that'll do for part 2. Part 3, we'll start at the Etihad. Welcome to part 3 of the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Man City, Liverpool. We will be doing a special extra pod tomorrow with a surprise guest list. I don't know who's on. Does anyone know who's on?
I don't.
No?
Well, I know I am.
Oh, you are? Okay. Yes.
And I know I'm not.
It's less of a surprise.
I mean, when no one knows, that often means I end up being on it. But I've not heard anything so far.
Me and producer Jonathan were chatting about it yesterday, saying it. You know, I know we sensationalise a lot, or we try not to, but this is the biggest game in the Premier League for a number of years, I feel. You know, two teams playing against each other, because the gap is so big. It's not like if they were level on points, you'd think, well, it would just be advantage City or advantage Liverpool, but like crucial for Man City.
Yeah, the gap's just the right amount to make it really significant, because if Liverpool win this, then it's very hard to see them being caught. If they lose it, then 4 points is very catch-upable.
Fascinating to
That's
know.
Maths.
That is maths. It's hard to find weaknesses in the Liverpool team, right? That's if you study the team they'll put out. Maybe Lovren, maybe their midfield. If they play a sort of Milner, Henderson, Wijnaldum, that's not as good at football as a Fernandinho, De Bruyne, and Silva combination. But they've been very good.
You sort of feel the game's coming exactly the right time for Liverpool, hasn't it? They're absolutely the peak of confidence and form, and City just stuttering a bit. So,
and City have an issue at left back.
Yeah,
which you think Klopp will target?
It's Mendy injured, Delph suspended, Zinchenko didn't look that comfortable against Southampton. And so you think of, I mean, presumably Salah will pull right again if it's a 4-3-3 rather than a 4-2-3-1. Or maybe not. Maybe Klopp goes gung-ho and sticks Shaqiri against him and plays Salah through the middle.
Pep has beaten Klopp just once in the Premier League. The 5-0 at the start of last season when Sadio Mane was sent off pretty early on. Apart from that, 2 wins to Liverpool, 2 draws, along with a City win in the Carabao and Liverpool's 2 wins in the Champions League last year. Josh says, what is Barry's prediction for the Liverpool-City game? Cards, goals, corners, the lot. I want to have something to hold over him when he's almost inevitably not 100% correct.
I have absolutely no idea who's going to win this game. If you give me £100 to bet on it, I wouldn't know what to do. It's a funny one. Everyone's hoping for an absolute belter, and we may not get one. When they met in October, it was a scoreless draw. City were uncharacteristically cagey, I think, because they'd got, you know, been beaten twice by Liverpool in the previous season. Admittedly, they also hammered Liverpool on one occasion. But they can't afford to be that cagey again, because they need to win this game, whereas Liverpool don't. And it should be intriguing. I honestly couldn't call it.
Lars, can you call it?
No, and it's interesting that Klopp is the manager who has the best record against Pep Guardiola's teams in general, I believe.
By miles. I mean, it's not even close. And if anybody's played him sort of a reasonable number of times.
Yeah, and you wonder if it's his sort of high-pressing ways that unsettles the sort of intricate passing of the Guardiola teams a little bit. And he's one of the very few, you'll know better than me, Jonathan, but he seems to be one of the few opposing managers that can actually make Guardiola change his methods. Like, he will adapt his approach sometimes to these games because he's worried about the club teams.
Yeah, I mean, there was a German Cup game when he stuck Javi Martinez up front and just played long to get over the Dortmund press. I don't really think he's got an option like that here. But I think you generally see, if you put pressure on City, they are vulnerable. But it's a massive gamble, because if you do it and it goes wrong, you can get beat 5 or 6-0. But we saw Southampton trouble them at times by pressing them hard. So, yeah, if Southampton can do it, clearly Liverpool are going to be able to do it much better.
And the thing about all these passes they play City, it's not just moving the ball around for the sake of it. I mean, it's about building the team structure and getting players into the right positions to get the shape that he wants. In the Marty Pernow book, it was suggested that he wanted 15 passes for the team to get the right structure.
Yeah, I think he said 15 passes to get the structure right, yeah.
Right, so it's about building the shapes that he wants on the pitch.
But that's once the opportunity of a quick transition
is there.
And you reset and it takes 15 passes to kind of get that. That's
very comparable to the early game in chess in that regard. And I think what Klopp's teams tend to do very well is disrupt that whole process. Now, even though that carries a tremendous amount of risk, because they have so much pace that if they do go past you, they can hurt you in a big way. It could also cause a bit of blood trouble.
Look, we'll review it tomorrow with the surprise pod, which is not a surprise lineup of a pod. I was excited. If I built it up enough, I mean, I don't know who it is. Do you know who it is, Barry?
No.
Oh, it's exciting. How excited you'd be? What do you want? Angela Lansbury and Carl Kennedy from Neighbours.
Be Steve Bruce. Might be on his bucket list.
Oh, yeah. Get Steve Bruce in. Is Angela still with us?
Yeah. Very much so.
Very much so, Angela Lansbury. Must be about 95.
Well, you're either alive or dead.
So very well, unless you're Manuel Pellegrini, of course. An interesting story yesterday about football mascots. Swansea getting in trouble, saying they're in football second tier. They're charging parents Premier League prices for children to be mascots. It costs up to £478 for a match day mascot package.
Only £478.
It depends what you get, I guess, for that, doesn't it? I mean,
I'm not sure could, it does.
I'd want a game.
I don't know. Take the player home for a couple of days afterwards, like, you know, mow the lawn or whatever.
Only three teams in the Premier League charge more. The experience is free at most top clubs. Cardiff charged £255. Swansea said prices were reduced this year following relegation.
I'm not sure why this is suddenly news. I mean, this has been common knowledge for a long time that many clubs charge ridiculously expensive fees for kids to be
mascots. I think for some of them, so Everton, I think the money all goes to Everton in the community. So some of them charge but give the money to good causes. Some of them do it for free. I mean, isn't a bigger issue just the general cost of tickets for fans, right? And trying to help subsidise a section of your ground. It's a business, but subsidising something for kids from poor schools, that would be that's a bigger story, right?
Yeah, you saw this, and my instinctive reaction is Premier League clubs charge their fans way too much for all the things, it seems. So what else is new? And I think the statistics, if I'm not mistaken, I believe the Premier League has a notoriously high average wage, notoriously high average age of their attendances. I think fans in general, match-going fans, are getting older, and there's a concern that young people aren't going to games and aren't growing up with going to the football as part of their life. And long-term, that could be a very bad thing.
In slightly different news, did anyone see Diego Costa waking up his brother?
Yes.
Would you like to talk us through it, Barry?
I'm not quite sure what he had. His brother was asleep in what looked like a hotel bed, and Diego Costa woke him up by placing a basin full of firecrackers or magnesium or something in water. But there was quite a little mini pyrotechnic display, which scared the bejesus out of his brother and looked like it could have started a fire. So I don't have brothers, but I guess that's the kind of thing they get up to.
I mean, I was probably naively surprised at how much Diego Costa's brother looked like Diego Costa. Of course he would. What's the worst way you've ever been woken up? I once fell asleep in a taxi, and one of my friends basically, I would say, kissed a shot of vodka into my mouth. It was a very disappointing moment. Yeah. I mean, I wasn't happy then. I wouldn't be happy now. And I'd like to say I no longer hang around with him, but I do.
Right.
It was truly devastating. Warm, sticky. Ugh. Anyway, FA Cup third round weekend. So Tranmere Spurs, their first meeting since 2002. Blackpool Arsenal. Arsenal not Blackpool out of the League Cup earlier this season. Woking Watford. Are Woking the only non-league side still in it?
Tranmere, they're in League Two, aren't they? Well, I was looking at the draw. It's quite an interesting draw. So hats off to whoever pulled the balls out of the FA Tombola. But there's seven Premier League teams away against lower league opposition. Chelsea play Forest, who have eliminated the FA Cup holders on five of the six previous occasions they've faced them. There's a lot of Premier League teams who you suspect won't be that interested. Cardiff away at Gillingham, Burnley home to Barnsley, Liverpool entertain Wolves, and almost certainly have bigger fish to fry. Derby, Southampton. Southampton, you suspect, won't be too bothered about that one. Ditto Huddersfield at Bristol City, ditto Fulham, who entertain Oldham. And
two all Premier League ties. Yeah. Bournemouth, Brighton, Wolves, Liverpool.
And just the 10 games at 3 o'clock on Saturday. Which I think is an absolute disgrace.
Just finally, we were talking about on the last pod, you know, cliches you'd like people to stop using in 2019. And I think Rich has got us over a barrel here. He says, football cliches to be banned. The narrative. It's irritating at the best of times. You guys use it as if you're not involved in it. As though it's something
wrong.
Other
it's
people
wrong.
Come
it's
up
wrong.
With. God, I hate it.
It's a really useful word to describe a really useful phenomenon. I suggest he just doesn't understand what it means.
Okay.
Because the reason it's useful is that when you have a narrative, when you have a sort of preset template of how you think things are going to go, when something happens that conforms to that, you highlight it in a way you wouldn't if you weren't expecting it. And therefore, the narrative becomes self-fulfilling. So Spursiness, for instance. Mm. Spursiness is a narrative. We know what Spursiness is. Every time Spurs get in a position to do something good and mess it up, it's just them being Spursy. Well, maybe they just let in a brilliant goal against a brilliant team. You know, it happens. But it sort of reaffirms this issue of Spursiness, which then can create a mood of anxiety around the team and around the stadium. So these things are self-perpetuating. That's why narrative is useful if used correctly. The term narrative is useful.
There you go, Rich.
Have some of
back
that.
In your box, Rich.
Please contact us again, though. You know, we like the interaction. Yes, yeah.
There is this idea that football is actually a lot more random than we want to admit.
And life is a lot more random,
and we construct these sort of storylines to try to make sense of it and make it more entertaining and interesting.
But that's
for
not
all
just football. That is humanity. that is the story of our species.
Yeah. You're going down the sort of Herzogian sort of chaos, hostility, and murder path here now.
No, not yet.
Thanks for your time anyway, Jonathan.
No, it's been a pleasure.
Cheers, Lars.
Thanks, Max.
Cheers, Baz.
You're welcome.
We'll be back tomorrow.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.